The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth, and I'm here with IJ Senior Attorneys Rob Frommer and Rob Johnson to talk about an $85 million heist in Los Angeles, California. This wasn't a bank robbery or even the plot of a movie. It was a theft from ordinary citizens perpetrated by the FBI itself. Let's jump right in. Rob Frommer, can you set the stage? Where did the action happen?
All this went down in Los Angeles County at a place called U.S. Private Vaults. And for those of you who might not know what a private vault is, well, you're in company because I didn't really either until this case began. But what it is literally what it sounds like. It's a private security vault where people can store their valuables. Now, that's really important because in recent years, banks, which you probably think of when you think of a safe deposit box, have moved out of that business because they increasingly view them, at least according to one article in the New York Times, as more of a headache than they're worth. They're expensive to build, complicated to maintain, and they're not very lucrative. So banks would rather have you keep the money in their accounts where they can then lend it out and make more money. And so they've gotten out of the business. And given the dearth of boxes, private companies have stepped in, started on the West Coast, but now it's an increasing business throughout the United States.
So what kind of people use it? You said it's a safe deposit box. So this is just to store family heirlooms or important documents. What kinds of things do people keep here?
Oh, people keep all sorts of items in these private security boxes. Some people keep valuables there, you know, if they want to have access to cash or gold. Other people keep, like you said, family heirlooms, memorabilia. A wide variety of items are kept there. It's anything that people, you know, feel they want to keep safe and secure. That's why people rent safety deposit boxes. And I would point out that these private companies, they're filling a market need, given that banks have withdrawn from the market largely. But they also provide some really, really significant advantages compared to those traditional bank vaults. For instance, like at U.S. private vaults, box renters didn't need to have employees help them access the box. Usually, if you've ever been to a safe deposit box at a bank, you need to wait usually forever, for a bank employee to come and get so that you can get inside the vault and get access to your box. Here, though, at U.S. private vaults, they had a biometric reader. You could just walk right up, and it would scan your irises, and it verify your identity, and boom, you're in. So much, much more convenient. Plus, renters at U.S. private vaults got to keep all of their keys. That meant that they could feel safe that no one would access their box without their knowledge. And they also, U.S. private vaults also offered insurance and a number of different box sizes. Banks tended to have just a very few number of boxes, often the same size. And most importantly for a lot of people, these private companies tend to have, well, we've all heard the term banker's hours. Well, the private vaults do a little bit better than the banker's hours. They're open up later at night. They're open on the weekends. And so this is just a more convenient, secure place for people to keep those precious items.
Okay, so these sound like, it sounds like a place that offers services that ordinary people might want to use for a lot of reasons that everybody can relate to. How does the FBI get involved?
So the FBI, I think it's fair to say, doesn't like that these vaults provide people with a private, secure place to keep valuable property. Which, you know, sounds a little odd, but what's going on here is that the government doesn't like that people have a place to store cash or a place to store gold, other very valuable property that's outside of a bank account. Because they, you know, the government tracks and has a whole very sophisticated reporting system set up to keep track of everything that's going on in the traditional banking system. And cash, on the other hand, can't be tracked. It can't be monitored in that same way. And so the government increasingly is just treating cash and also, you know, things like gold or silver as inherently suspect, inherently criminal. And so the government sees, you know, here's a place with, 800 boxes, many of which are filled with, you know, gold and cash. I mean, we'll get to this later, but these boxes are, they contain over $85 million worth of cash, which is a lot of cash. And the FBI gets a warrant to come into the facility and to seize the nest of boxes. So not actually the insides of the boxes, but the nest of boxes. And then they say, well, because we're seizing the nest of boxes, we need to, quote, inventory everything that is inside of the boxes, because otherwise, oh no, they might get, stolen or lost. So they then break open the boxes, destroying them in the process. And they make this inventory. So they're, searching through, rifling through everything in the box. They're making a videotape the whole time. So if they, if there's a document, for instance, inside someone's box, they'll hold it up to the camera so the camera can see it and get a picture of what it says. And then all of this, supposedly to prevent theft and loss. But the great irony is that there was no risk of theft and loss from a locked box. The only risk of theft and loss arose when they broke it open and, had the agents going through them. And actually, we've had people who, come forward and said, there's one woman who's currently suing that, the FBI lost, I think it was like $70,000 worth of gold from her box. And there's other people who've made similar claims. So, it's almost a supreme irony where in this sort of pretextual search that's supposedly supposed to guard against theft and loss, they've actually created a huge risk of theft and loss from these otherwise secure boxes.
Let's talk about the warrant a little bit, because you explained the sort of thinking on the government's part here. It was the U.S. attorney in Southern California, just for whatever reason, like this is inherently suspect. But that doesn't seem like enough justification to get a warrant. So how did they went to the judge claiming what? And then that then eventually turned into this pretty dramatic search.
So what they said was that one of the employees of this bulk company was engaged in, some sort of shady activity. There are a few things. One, that they would sell gold to people, people might then keep in their box. And when they sold the gold, they would sell it in amounts under $10,000 to avoid there being a bank report. And then the other thing was that this employee was supposedly selling drugs out of essentially the lobby to the facility. And, all of that, yeah, that's bad. That's, illegal. At least the second thing is bad, and they're both illegal. So they get a warrant, and the warrant, though, is directed to the company.
Right, because it's the employee who's supposed to be the bad behavior here, or the bad actor.
Yeah, and so, they don't even go after the employee, they go after the company. And the reason for that is that what they really want to do is to seize this, nest of boxes with the ultimate goal of getting inside them. So they indict U.S. Private Bolts, the company. And to this day, if you look at the docket, like nothing has happened since this indictment. It just, there's an indictment and then nothing. And then they, based on having indicted the company, they get this warrant to seize the nest of boxes and then use that as the kind of hook to get inside. And this is kind of like if you had an apartment building and somebody accused the landlord of helping one of the people in one of the apartments steal drugs out of their apartment. And then the FBI comes in and says, well, now we got to search the whole building and every apartment inside this building. And that's just would be clearly unconstitutional in the context of an apartment. And it's clearly unconstitutional here as well.
And I think one of the things that makes it especially outrageous is didn't the warrant actually note that by saying, you don't have, maybe Rob Furmer, you could talk about that. What the judge, they went through the right process, right? They got the warrant and the judge took seriously the property right considerations. What happened there? How did it end up with them opening all these boxes and videotaping the contents?
Well, what happened here is that there was a big bait and switch by the FBI and the federal prosecutor. When they asked for the seizure warrant, they promised that all they were going to do was just go in just to identify people who owns what, so that they could just return that that property to the rightful owner. They promised that, then they wouldn't go any further than that. And the magistrate judge who signed the seizure warrant expressly said, this does not authorize a criminal search or seizure of the contents of those boxes. It again said, all you're supposed to do is figure out who owns what, hold it for safekeeping, give it back. But with that, once they had that warrant in hand, the FBI and the federal prosecutor immediately broke their word. When they marched in there on March 22nd, they brought tons of officers. They brought drug sniffing dogs to this. Now, there's no purpose in having a drug sniffing dog at just an inventory if your only job is to figure out who owns what. Why do you have a drug sniffing dog there? So they, as Rob Johnson was saying, they had the drug sniffing dogs. They videotaped all the box openings. But what's really creepy about it, and Rob alluded to this, is that they were opening sealed envelopes, sealed documents inside people's boxes, and then holding up the paper to the camera. You know, something that clearly the magistrate judge never said they could do, never even contemplated they could do. But once they were inside, they felt they could do whatever they wanted.
So they're in there. They've clearly, you know, you open the envelopes, you know whose stuff it is. Did they give it back?
Sorry.
Leading question. either of the Robs want to answer.
Well, you know, so it took them a very long time. And what they basically did is they went through and they said, if this is property that is of monetary value, like cash or gold, then we're going to forfeit it and we're going to keep it. And they sent people these forfeiture notices, which we can talk to later. And then, you know, for people who had sentimental property or property of, you know, sort of non-monetary value, then eventually they gave it back. And it took months. And, you know, the other thing they did is they rifled through all of it. And so people are getting this property back, but it's, you know, I actually went in person with some of our clients to get their property back. And we, you know, it was Paul and Jennifer Snitko. And they had to walk into an interrogation room in the FBI headquarters in Los Angeles. And, you know, the three of us sat down in this room, like you're on like The Wire or something. And, you know, there's like a camera shining down on you. And then they brought in all of this property in evidence bags, you know, and it had all been separated out into evidence bags. And, you know, Jennifer had, for instance, like coins, a sentimental value. And the FBI had counted all the coins and they had like a little receipt to say, like, you know, it's $2 in coins. You know, and then they had their baptismal certificates, for instance, in the box. And so the baptismal certificates are in like a little plastic bag that says evidence on it. And then they sit there in this room and they had to go through everything in the room to make sure it was all there. And it was just a violating experience.
So it's almost like having gone through TSA or something and getting your suitcase back out and finding all your clothes inside out. You know, and again, in this case, like completely unexpected. So you said that they gave back the stuff that's sentimental, the $2 in coins, the baptism, and then mentioned the concept of forfeiture. So what happened to the stuff that was valuable?
Well, it's important, and this is why it's pretty clear that this is an $85 million cash grab. We understand pretty clearly that the federal prosecutor in this divided all the boxes up into three categories. What clean, dirty, and I don't know. And the sole basis, from what we can tell, as to where any box and its contents fell was how valuable the stuff was inside. So take, for instance, we have a client, Tyler Gauthier, who had $2,000 worth of silver in there. You know, it's a decent amount of silver, but it's not a huge amount. The FBI gave him that back. But then look at our client, Joseph Ruiz. Joseph Ruiz is a blue-collar worker, got injured when a drunk driver hit him in a car accident, really messed up his back. He got a settlement, which he kept in the safe deposit box so he could use it for, you know, like physical therapy and basic living expenses. But $57,000 is a lot of money. So the FBI and the federal prosecutor, just on that basis alone, have moved to try forfeit Joseph's lifeline. And he's now been without that for months, and he's been resorting to eating food he stocked up before the pandemic. So we don't call this a cash grab lightly. The proof is in the government's actions here.
Well, and it's interesting because, you know, there's the specific story for where the money came from this accident, this insurance, you know. But he shouldn't have to prove that it's not criminal. So can we talk a little bit about how this, you know, how the fact that this is a civil forfeiture and what that means for the position that the property owners are in?
So you got to basically distinguish between civil and criminal forfeiture, right? And so the whole idea of criminal forfeiture is the government thinks you've done something wrong. They convict you of a crime, you know, following all the procedures that we all are familiar with from Law and Order. And then they, you know, having done that, they can take property that was used in the crime or that was, you know, the proceeds of the crime. And there's no problem with that. But what there is a problem with is what's called civil forfeiture, which allows the government to take your property and then put the burden on you as the property owner to prove that you did nothing wrong, to prove your own innocence in order to get the property back. And what that does is it takes the fundamental idea of innocent until proven guilty, and it just turns it on its head. And, you know, that's what all of these property owners are being subjected to. And actually, this is one of the most outrageous instances of that that we've ever seen, because what they're doing is they're not even saying, well, you know, we think you're a drug dealer, prove that you're not. They're just saying, well, we think you have a bunch of cash in a box, so we think you must have done something wrong, and we're not even going to tell you what it is, but you have to come forward and you have to prove your innocence in order to get your property back. Well, you know, innocence of what?
Yeah, but it's sort of like what, like proving a negative. It's an impossible situation, outrageous story. Very clear that there is wrong done here, and why these property owners would want to sue. So they joined with IJ. We did step in, filed a lawsuit. Fromer, can you talk a little bit about the legal claims that we're making in that lawsuit?
Absolutely. Well, the government's actions here are incredibly constitutional, not just like the initial raid, but the fact that they're keeping people in the dark as to what's happening with their property, what they're being accused of having done wrong. So we bring claims under both the Fourth Amendment, which is the protections against unreasonable searches and seizures, and the Fifth Amendment, which helps protect people's rights to due process. And the Fourth Amendment claims are pretty simple. The government violated the warrant. The government violated the Fourth Amendment when it conducted a criminal search without any evidence of the box owners having done anything wrong. It violated the Fourth Amendment by holding on to people's property and not giving it back to them when they ask and not telling them what they did wrong. The Fifth Amendment claims are similar. This goes more towards some of the forfeiture notices that the government sent out. And Rob Johnson was just mentioning this. Those notices didn't tell people anything about what they did wrong. It didn't list like a substantive statute that they are alleged to have violated. They didn't list any facts about what they did wrong. The entire notice just said, like, your property is being forfeited subject to the civil forfeiture laws. The end. But what can you do in response to that? The answer is nothing. And that's the problem. Under the Fifth Amendment, you have a right to actually know what the government's accusing you of so that you can defend yourself. And that's why we brought this lawsuit. And that's why we moved for a restraining or an injunction preventing the government from permanently forfeiting the property of our clients and other class members without telling them what they did wrong. And that's what the judge ultimately agreed with us on that.
So one additional component of this lawsuit is that it is actually structured as a class action lawsuit, which I think a lot of listeners might hear and immediately think of the notices that they get from MasterCard or a health insurance company and think that, you know, attorneys like you folks are going to make a ton of money on this and the box holders get $12. Why is that not what is happening here? Why would we approach this as a class action from a public interest perspective where it's not about a payout?
Yeah, we do class actions not as a payout, but because we're trying to secure real relief for as many people as possible. In a class action, it's important to remember, like in a traditional lawsuit, really, the effect of the lawsuit is only to the people who are in the lawsuit, the actual named plaintiff and defendant. But a class action allows us to secure broader relief for everybody who's been affected by sort of a common thing. And here, it's not just our seven clients who've been affected by the raid at U.S. Private Vaults. It's hundreds of people. So by filing a class action, we can try to secure relief and help all those people at once. It's also incredibly useful because often what the government will try to do when we bring a case again with a single plaintiff is they'll try to immediately try to give back the money or immediately try to fix the problem and then run to the court and say, dismiss this case. There's nothing here anymore. We took care of it. So, but by bringing it as a class action, that allows us to keep pressing forward, even if they give like Paul and Jennifer Snitko their property back, or in our Philadelphia forfeiture case, the Sorovelises got their house back. It allows those clients who are rightfully riled up about what the government's done to them to keep pressing forward, not even for themselves at that point, but for everyone else who's still stuck in that situation.
And that it would make it different from a traditional sort of IJ case where we set the precedent and then others in that situation could bring their own lawsuit and win under the new rule of law that we've established. This, because the nature of the abuse is just sort of dramatic and widespread and pretty specific, you can try to deal with it all at once.
Exactly. Because everyone here, usually you can't bring a class action because the injuries that people have come from, they might have like a common legal point, but they don't all come from like a common scheme. In Philadelphia, in our Philadelphia forfeiture, the thousands of people who are wrapped up in that all suffered at the hands of the Philadelphia forfeiture machine. Similarly here, the hundreds of people who rented boxes at U.S. Private Vaults all are suffering this pretty much the same kind of harm because of what the government did, because of the government's actions. And because since there's a common action by a common defendant, why not be able to get relief for everybody all at once?
Yeah, and I think just to be like really clear about it, like we're not seeking damages in this case. Like we are seeking an injunction that requires the government to give the property back and also to destroy the records that it made of what was inside the boxes. So, you know, it's just, you can do a class action for damages, but this is not that. This is a class action to get injunctive relief that applies to everybody in the class.
Which is probably something that a lot of people don't even realize. Because again, we referenced Law and Order before with the evidence bags and stuff. And, you know, it just, the popular perception is, I think, is very different. So in this case, one of the things that I think makes it especially cool is that we talk a lot about Fourth Amendment rights and the idea of protection against search and seizure, and often run into the idea that, well, if you don't have anything to hide, why is it a problem? And this case, I think, is a very dramatic instance of the ways that it can become a problem, even for people who don't have something to hide. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that from the legal perspective, like the importance of Fourth Amendment protections and sort of the due process protections against forfeiture, civil forfeitures like this, for people who, like our clients, are completely innocent and have nothing to hide.
Well, I mean, a few centuries ago, there was a powerful French cardinal called Cardinal Richelieu. And he has a line, and it's apocryphal, but I love it for this point. It says, if one would give me six lines written by the hand of the most honest man, I would find something in them to have him hanged. Now, a little more modern day, author Harvey Silvergates estimated that the common person on average commits three felonies a day without even knowing it. And really, on a more fundamental personal level, imagine you're sitting at home and all of a sudden the police just barged in and just started searching, tearing up your place, looking in every nook and cranny, you know, reading through your diaries, checking, you know, all the most private spaces. How would that make you feel? It'd make you feel violated. And I think that's because fundamentally, the right to be secure in our persons and property is a fundamental human desire. We all want our own space. We all want our own domain where we can be ourselves, where we can feel secure. And if the government can just break in and rifle around whenever they want, there's no way you can ever feel secure. And that's what the framers of the Constitution were trying to protect with the Fourth Amendment, and that's what we're trying to protect here.
So you did you want to add something, Rob?
Oh, you know, I guess I would just add to that. I mean, I think this idea of that somebody is a criminal just because they're trying to keep financial information secret from the government. You know, this idea that like the government has to know everything that you do with your money, and that if you're using cash or you're holding gold and the government doesn't know about it, that that's somehow suspect. I mean, that's very troubling. And it's something that we're seeing in other fields too, as the government is proposing to increase the scope of reporting about bank accounts. I mean, there are currently proposals to have, you know, far more comprehensive reporting than even currently exists. And government's, you know, also proposing to extend that to cryptocurrency. And what we're seeing is this attack on the very idea of financial privacy. And I think that's extraordinarily troubling, because if you're, you know, you think about it, anything that you do in life on some level requires expenditures of money. I mean, there's just nothing you're going to do that's meaningful that doesn't require spending money in some way. And if the government can know how you spend all your money, then you really don't have any privacy at all. So there's really no distinction between financial privacy and just privacy at large.
You mentioned earlier that that the judge agreed with us preliminarily in this case about the government's behavior with respect to the warrant and the seizures. How will the law change in these areas if we prevail in the end? And actually, even before we get to that, could you talk a little bit about that preliminary victory, what it means, and then and where we go from here?
As I mentioned before, the government tried to move, tried to forfeit, about 400 safe deposit boxes. And the notices they sent out, as I mentioned, don't actually say what anybody did wrong. They don't say the law. They don't say the facts. All they say is, we're trying to forfeit your stuff. You know, if you want to do something about it, here's how. And we said to the judge, Your Honor, like under due process, basic notions of due process, like I need to understand what the government thinks I did, what the government thinks my property did, so I can respond. Like, you know,
this is insane.
Yeah. How am I supposed to react to this? And our clients, when they got these notices, were like, what are we supposed to do with this? And so we showed them to the judge and we said, Judge, you can't allow them to try to permanently forfeit property based on these because they don't say anything. And the judge agreed. First, he entered a temporary restraining order, which he then converted to a preliminary injunction. And what he said is that these notices were woefully inadequate. And I think, and I'm going to paraphrase, I'll probably butcher it a little, but put bluntly, these notices provide no factual basis whatsoever. And it was clear as day that these notices were unclear as they possibly could be. And so the judge agreed and stopped those forfeitures from moving forward. Now, that was just on behalf of our clients, but we're working towards securing a class so that that ruling can have broad effect to everyone.
And a quick interjection there. I'm curious about the just blatant disregard for the restrictions of the warrant. I mean, did he scold them or penalize them, or were there any consequences whatsoever for people entrusted with public power who got permission to do something under pretty specific circumstances and then completely ignored it?
Not yet.
No.
But I mean, look, that those claims are still, you know, the way that's going to get litigated is our claim for to destroy the records of the search. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're, even if they give back all of this property, we're still going to be litigating that issue. And the judges, you know, he hasn't reached it yet, but he will. And I think that at some point, somebody is going to say, you know, you can't do that. I have to believe that.
Well, and that gets a little bit to that other aspect of the question, which is the consequences of this. So, you know, the importance of prevailing here so that it doesn't become routine in Los Angeles to lie about what you're going to do when you get on somebody's private property. Yeah.
The big concern here is that if the FBI and the U.S. Attorney are able to get away with this and, you know, collect $100 million, you know, of other people's money. That's a huge dollar sign. You can just see other jurisdictions, other agencies saying, well, we have some places like that here. I'm sure if the one in LA wasn't on the up and up, then I'm sure ours isn't either. And we could see this happen over and over again. And really, and then it started expanding to anywhere where you rent a space, like a storage unit, even an apartment building. You know, Rob puts forward that apartment building analogy is sort of like no one would ever think that. But if we don't stop this action here in its tracks, who knows if that won't be, you know, a crazy story 10 years down the line.
Well, thank you both for the fighting this important fight and for joining me today. Thank you to everyone for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and you'd like to hear more like it, you can find more episodes of Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe.